He was a young man about 30 years old, well-educated and a good cleric. But the two oldest sons never warmed to him. With Gauta, on the other hand, he soon became good friends. Gauta was the only one of Erlan's sons who had made friends among the people of Seal, but none of the others had continued to be as much an outsider as Nicholas was. He never had anything to do with the other youths. If he went to the places where young people gathered to dance or meet, he usually stood on the outskirts of the green to watch, asserting by his demeanor that he was too good to take part. But if he was so inclined, he might join in the games unasked, and then everyone saw that he was doing it to show off. He was vigorous, strong, and agile, and it was easy to provoke him to fight. But after he had defeated two or three of the most renowned opponents in the parish, people had to tolerate his presence. And if he wished to dance with a maiden, he paid no heed to her brothers or kinsmen, but simply danced with the girl and walked and sat with her alone. No woman ever said no when Nicholas Erlandsson requested her company, which did not make people like him any better. After his brother had gone blind, Nokva seldom left his side, but if he went out in the evening, he acted no differently from before. For the most part, he also gave up his long hunting expeditions, but that fall he had bought himself an exceedingly costly white falcon from the sheriff, and he was as eager as ever to practice his bowmanship and prowess in sports. Björgulf had taught himself to play chess blind, and the brothers would often spend an entire day at the chessboard. They were both the most zealous of players. Then Kristin heard people talking about Nokva and a young maiden, Tordis Gunnar's daughter from Skene. The following summer she was staying up in the mountain pastures. Many times Nokva was away from home at night. Kristin found out that he had been with Tordis. The mother's heart trembled and twisted and turned like an aspen leaf on its stem. Tordis belonged to an old and respected family. She herself was a good and innocent child. Nokva couldn't possibly mean to dishonor her. If the two young people forgot themselves, then he would have to make the girl his wife. Sick with anguish and shame, Kristin realized nevertheless that she would not be overly aggrieved if this should happen. Only 2 years ago, she would never have stood for it if Tordis Gunnar's daughter were to succeed her as the mistress of Urengard. The maiden's grandfather was still alive and lived on his estate with four married sons. She herself had many siblings. She would not be a wealthy bride. And every woman of that lineage had given birth to at least one witless child. The children were either exchanged at birth or possessed by the mountain spirits. No matter how they strove to protect the women in childbed, neither baptism nor sacred incantations seemed to help. There were now two old men at Skene whom Sira Eirik had judged to be changelings, as well as two children who were deaf and mute. And the wood nymph had bewitched Tordis's older brother when he was 17. Otherwise, those belonging to the Skene lineage were a handsome lot. Their livestock flourished, and good fortune followed them. But they were too numerous for their family to have any wealth. God only knew whether Nokva could have abandoned his resolve without sinning if he had already promised himself to the service of the Virgin Mary. But a man always had to spend 1 year as a young brother in the monastery before he was ordained. He could withdraw voluntarily if he realized that he was not meant to serve God in that way. And she had heard that the French countess who was the mother of the great doctor of theology, the friar Sir Thomas Aquinas, had locked her son in with a beautiful, wanton woman in order to shake his resolve when he wanted to retreat from the world. Kristin thought this was the vilest thing she had ever heard, and yet when the woman died, she had reconciled with God. So it must not be such a terrible sin if Kristin now imagined that she would open her arms to embrace Tordis of Skene as the wife of her son. In the autumn, Jamalt Halvardsson came to Formo, and he confirmed the rumors of great news that had also reached the valley. In consultation with the highest leaders of the church and Norway's council of knights and noblemen, King Magnus Eiriksson had decided to divide his realms between the two sons he had fathered with his queen, Lady Blanche. At the meeting of nobles in Vardberg, he had given the younger son, Prince Haakon, the title of King of Norway. Both learned priests and laymen of the gentry had sworn sacred oaths to defend the land under his hand. He was supposed to be a handsome and promising 3-year-old child, and he was to be brought up in Norway with 4 foster mothers, all the most high-born wives of knights, and with 2 spiritual and 2 worldly chieftains as his foster fathers when King Magnus and Queen Blanche were in Sweden. It was said that Sir Erling Vidkunsson and the bishops of Bjørgvin and Oslo were behind this selection of a sovereign, and Bjarne Erlingsson had presented the matter to the king. Lord Magnus loved Bjarne above all his other Norwegian men. Everyone expected the greatest benefits for the realm of Norway now that they would once again have a king who was reared and lived among them, who would protect the laws and rights and interests of the country, instead of squandering his time, energies, and the wealth of the kingdom on incursions in other lands. Kristin had heard about the selection of a king, just as she had heard about the discord with the German merchants in Bjørgvin and about the king's wars in Sweden and Denmark. But these events had touched her so little. Like the echo of thunder from the mountains after a storm had passed over the countryside and was far away. No doubt her sons had discussed these matters with each other. Jamal's account threw the sons of Erland into a state of violent agitation. Bjørgulf sat with his forehead resting in his hand so he could hide his blind eyes. Gaute listened with his lips parted as his fingers tightly clenched the hilt of his dagger. Lavrans' breathing was swift and audible, and all of a sudden he turned away from his uncle and looked at Nakva, sitting in the high seat. The oldest son's face was pale, and his eyes blazed. "It has been the fate of many a man," said Nakva, "that those who were his fiercest opponents in life found success on the road he had pointed out to them, but only after they had made him into fodder for the worms. After his mouth was stuffed with earth, the lesser men no longer shrank from affirming the truth of his words." "That may well be, kinsman," said Jamalt in a placating tone. "You may be right about that. Your father was the first of all men to think of this way out of the foreign lands, with 2 brothers on the thrones, here and in Sweden. Erland Nikolausen was a deep-thinking, wise, and magnanimous man, I see that. But take care what you now say, Nikolaus. Surely you wouldn't want your words to be spread as gossip that might harm Skula." "Skula didn't ask my permission to do what he did," said Nakva sharply. "No, he probably didn't remember that you had come of age by now," replied Jamalt in the same tone as before, "and I didn't think about it either. So it was with my consent and blessing that he placed his hand on Bjarne's sword and swore allegiance. I think he did remember it, but the whelp knew I would never give my consent. And no doubt the Giske men needed this salve for their guilty consciences." Skule Erlandsson had joined Bjarne Erlingsson as one of his loyal men. He had met the great chieftain when he was visiting his aunt at Ahlin during Christmas, and Bjarne had explained to the boy that it was largely due to the intercession of Sir Erling and himself that Erland had been granted his life. Without their support, Simon Andresen would never have been able to accomplish his mission with King Magnus. Ivar was still with Inga Fluga. Kristin knew that what Bjarne Erlingsson had said was not entirely untrue. It was in accordance with Simon's own account of his journey to Tunsberg. And yet, during all these years, she had always thought of Erling Vidkunsson with great bitterness. It seemed to her that he should have been able to help her husband attain better terms if he had wished to do so. Bjarne hadn't been capable of much back then, as young as he was. But she wasn't pleased that Skule had joined up with this man, and in an odd way it took her breath away that the twins had acted on their own and had set off into the world. They were no more than children, she thought. After Jamalt's visit, the uneasiness of her mind grew so great that she hardly dared think at all. If it was true what the men said, that the prosperity and security of the people of the realm would increase beyond words if this small boy in Tunsberg Castle were now called Norway's king, then they could have been enjoying this turn of events for almost 10 years if Erland hadn't... No, She refused to think about that when she thought about the dead. But she couldn't help it, because she knew that in her son's eyes their father was magnificent and perfect, the most splendid warrior and chieftain, without faults or flaws. And she herself had thought, during all these years, that Erland had been betrayed by his peers and wealthy kinsmen. Her husband had suffered great injustice. But Nokva went too far when he said that they had made him into fodder for the worms. She too bore her own heavy share of the blame, but it was mostly Erland's folly and his desperate obstinacy that had brought about his wretched death. But no. All the same, she wasn't pleased that Skúla was now in the service of Bjarne Erlingsson. Would she ever live to see the day when she was released from the ceaseless torment of anguish and unrest? Oh, Jesus, remember the anguish and grief that your own mother bore for your sake. Have mercy on me, a mother, and give me comfort. She felt uneasy even about Gauta. The boy had the makings of the most capable of farmers, but he was so impetuous in his eagerness to restore prosperity to his lineage. Nokva gave him free rein, and Gauta had his hands in so many enterprises. With several other men of the parish, he had now started up the old iron smelting sites in the mountains. And he sold off far too much. He sold not only the goods from the land leases, but also part of the yield from his own estate. All her days, Kristen had been used to seeing full storerooms and stalls on her farm, and she grew a little cross with Gauta when he frowned in disapproval at the rancid butter and made fun of the 10-year-old bacon she had hung up. But she wanted to know that on her manor there would never be a shortage of food. She would never have to turn a poor man away unaided if years of drought should strike the countryside. And there would be nothing lacking when the time came for weddings and christening feasts and banquets to be held once again on the old estate. Her ambitious hopes for her sons had been diminished. She would be content if they would settle down here in her parish. She could combine and exchange her properties in such a fashion that three of them could live on their own estates. And Jurengard, along with the portion of Laugarbru that lay on this side of the river, could feed three leaseholders. They might not be circumstances fit for noblemen, but they wouldn't be poor folk either. Peace reigned in the valley. Here little was said about all the unrest among chieftains of the land. If this should be perceived as a decline in the power and prestige of their lineage, well, God would be able to further the interests of their descendants if he saw that it would be to their benefit. But surely it would be vain of her to hope that she might see them all gathered around here in this manner. It was unlikely they would settle down so easily, these sons of hers, who had Erland Nikolason as their father. During this time, her soul found peace and solace whenever she let her thoughts dwell on the two children she had laid to rest up in the cemetery. Every day, over the ensuing years, she had thought of them. As she watched children of the same age grow and thrive, she would wonder how her own would have looked by now. As she went about her daily chores, just as diligent and hard-working as ever, but reticent and preoccupied, her dead children were always with her. In her dreams, they grew older and flourished, and they turned out, in every way, to be exactly as she had wished. Munan was as loyal to his kinsmen as Nokva, but he was as cheerful and talkative with his mother as Gauta was, and he never worried her with unwise impulses. He was as gentle and thoughtful as Lavrans, but Munan would tell his mother all the strange things he was pondering. He was as clever as Björgulf, but no misfortune clouded his way through life, so his wisdom held no bitterness. He was as self-reliant, strong, and bold as the twins, but not as unruly or stubborn. And she recalled once more all the sweet, merry memories of the loving charm of her children when they were small every time she thought about little Erland. He stood on her lap, waiting to be dressed. She put her hands around his chubby, naked body, and he reached up with his small hands and face and his whole precious body toward her face and her caresses. She taught him to walk. She had placed a folded cloth across his chest and up under his arms. He hung in this harness, as heavy as a sack, vigorously fumbling backward with his feet. Then he laughed until he was wriggling like a worm from laughter. She carried him in her arms out to the farmyard to see the calves and lambs, and he shrieked with joy at the sow with all her piglets. He leaned his head back and gaped at the doves perched in the stable hayloft. He ran to her in the tall grass around the heaps of stones, crying out at each berry he saw and eating them out of her hand so avidly that her palm was wet from his greedy little mouth. All the joys of her children she remembered and relived in this dream life with her two little sons, and all her sorrows she forgot. It was spring for the third time since Erlan had been laid in his grave. Kristin heard no more about Tordis and Nokva. Neither did she hear anything about the cloister. And her hope grew. She couldn't help it. She was so reluctant to sacrifice her eldest son to the life of a monk. Right before St. Yon's Day, Ivar Erlandsson came home to Urengard. The twins had been young lads in their 16th year when they left home. Now Ivar was a grown man, almost 18 years old, and his mother thought he had become so handsome and manly that she could hardly get her fill of looking at him. On the first morning, Kristin took breakfast up to Ivar as he lay in bed. Honey-baked wheat bread, lefse, and ale that she had tapped from the last keg of Christmas brew. She sat on the edge of his bed while he ate and drank, smiling at everything he said. She got up to look at his clothes, turning and fingering each garment. She rummaged through his traveling bag and weighed his new silver brooch in her slender reddish-brown hand. She drew his dagger out of its sheath and praised it, along with all his other possessions. Then she sat down on the bed again, looked at her son, and listened with a smile in her eyes and on her lips to everything the young man told her. Then Ivar said, "I might as well tell you why I've come home, Mother. I've come to obtain Nokva's consent for my marriage." Overwhelmed, Kristin clasped her hands together. "My Ivar, as young as you are, surely you haven't committed some folly?" Ivar begged his mother to listen. She was a young widow, Sina Gamal's daughter of Ronheim in Fauskar. The estate was worth 6 marks in land taxes, and most of it was her sole property, which she had inherited through her only child. But she had become embroiled in a lawsuit with her husband's kinsman, and Inga Fluga had tried to acquire all manner of unlawful benefits for himself if he was to help the widow win justice. Ivar had become indignant and had taken up the woman's defense, accompanying her to the bishop himself, for Lord Hallvard had always shown Ivar a fatherly goodwill every time they had met. Inga Munansson's actions in the county could not bear close scrutiny, but he had been wise enough to stay on friendly terms with the nobles of the countryside, frightening the peasants into their mouse holes. And he had thrown sand in the bishop's eyes with his great cleverness. It was doubtless for Munan's sake that Lord Hallvard had refrained from being too stern. But now things did not look good for Inga, so the cousins had parted with the gravest enmity when Ivar took his horse and rode off from Inga Fluga's manor. Then he had decided to pay a visit at Ronheim, in the south, before he left the region. That was at Easter time, and he had been staying with Sina ever since, helping her on the estate in the springtime. Now they had agreed that he would marry her. She didn't think that Ivar Erlandsson was too young to be her husband and protect her interests, and the bishop, as he had said, looked on him with favor. He was still much too young and lacking in learning for Lord Hallvard to appoint him to any position, but Ivar was convinced that he would do well if he settled at Ronheim as a married man. Kristin sat fidgeting with her keys in her lap. This was sensible talk, and Inga Fluga certainly deserved no better. But she wondered what that poor old man, Munan Bardsson, would say about all this. About the bride, she learned that Sina was 30 winters old, from a low-born and impoverished family, but her first husband had acquired much wealth, so that she was now comfortably situated, and she was an honorable, kind, and diligent woman. Nikolaus and Gauta accompanied Ivar south to have a look at the widow, but Kristin wanted to stay home with Björgulf. When her sons returned, Nakfa could tell his mother that Ivar was now betrothed to Sina Gamalsdottir. The wedding would be celebrated at Rongheim in the autumn. Not long after his arrival back home, Nakfa came to see his mother one evening as she sat sewing in the weaving room. He barred the door. Then he said that now that Gauta was 20 years old, and Ivar would also come of age by marrying, he and Björgulf intended to journey north in the fall and ask to be accepted as novices at the monastery. Kristin said little. They spoke mainly about how they would arrange those things that her two oldest sons would want to take with them from their inheritance. But a few days later, men came to Jurengard with an invitation to a betrothal banquet. Osmund of Schenna was going to celebrate the betrothal of his daughter Tordis to a good farmer's son from Dovre. That evening, Nakfa came again to see his mother in the weaving room, and once again he barred the door behind him. He sat on the edge of the hearth, poking a twig into the embers. Kristin had lit a small fire since the nights were cold that summer. "Nothing but feasts and carousing, my mother," he said with a little laugh. "The betrothal banquet at Rongheim, and the celebration at Schenna, and then Ivar's wedding. When Tordis rides in her wedding procession, I doubt I'll be riding along. By that time I will have donned cloister garb." Kristin didn't reply at once. But then, without looking up from her sewing, she was making a banquet tunic for Ivar, she said. "Many probably thought it would be a great sorrow for Tordis Gunnarsdottir if you became a monk." "I once thought so myself," replied Nakfa. Kristin let her sewing sink to her lap. She looked at her son. His face was impassive and calm. And he was so handsome. His dark hair brushed back from his white forehead, curling softly behind his ears and along the slender tan stalk of his neck. His features were more regular than his father's. His face was broader and more solid. His nose not as big, and his mouth not as small. His clear blue eyes were lovely beneath the straight black brows. And yet he didn't seem as handsome as Erland had been. It was his father's animal-like softness and languid charm, his air of inextinguishable youth that Nakfa did not possess. Kristin picked up her work again, but she didn't go back to sewing. After a moment, as she looked down and tucked in a hem of the cloth with her needle, she said, "Do you realize, Nakfa, that I haven't voiced a single word of objection to your godly plans? I wouldn't dare do so. But you're young, and you know quite well, being more learned than I am, that it is written somewhere that it ill suits a man to turn around and look over his shoulder once he has set his hand to the plow." Not a muscle moved in her son's face. "I know that you've had these thoughts in mind for a long time," continued his mother, "ever since you were children. But back then you didn't understand what you would be giving up. Now that you've reached the age of a man, don't you think it would be advisable if you waited a while longer to see if you have the calling? You were born to take over this estate and become the head of your lineage. You dare to advise me now?" Nakfa took several deep breaths. He stood up. All of a sudden he slapped his hand to his breast and tore open his tunic and shirt so his mother could see his naked chest where his birthmark, the 5 little blood-red fiery specks, shone amid the black hair. "I suppose you thought I was too young to understand what you were sighing about with moans and tears whenever you kissed me here, back when I was a little lad. I may not have understood, but I could never forget the words you spoke. Mother, mother, have you forgotten that father died the most wretched of deaths, unconfessed and unanointed? And you dare to dissuade us? I think Björgulf and I know what we're turning away from. It doesn't seem to me such a great sacrifice to give up this estate and marriage, or the kind of peace and happiness that you and father had together during all the years I can remember." Kristin put down her sewing. All that she and Erland had lived through, both bad and good, a wealth of memories washed over her. The child understood so little when he was renouncing. With all his youthful fights, bold exploits, careless dealings, and games of love, He was no more than an innocent child. Nokfa saw the tears well up in his mother's eyes. He shouted, Quid mihi et tibi est, mulie? Kristen cringed, but her son spoke with violent agitation. God did not say those words because he felt scorn for his mother. But he chastised her, that pure pearl without blemish or flaw, when she tried to counsel him on how to use the power that he had been given by his father in heaven and not by his mother's flesh. Mother, you must not advise me about this. Do not venture to do so. Kristen bent her head to her breast. After a moment, Nokfa said in a low voice, Have you forgotten, Mother, that you pushed me away? He paused, as if he didn't trust his own voice. But then he continued, I wanted to kneel beside you at my father's deathbed, but you told me to go away. Don't you realize my heart wails in my chest whenever I think about that? Kristen whispered, almost inaudibly, Is that why you've been so cold toward me during all these years I've been a widow? Her son was silent. I begin to understand. You've never forgiven me for that, have you, Nokfa? Nokfa looked away. Sometimes. I have forgiven you, Mother, he said, his voice faint. But not very often. Oh, Nokfa, Nokfa, she cried bitterly. Do you think I loved Bjergulf any less than you? I'm his mother. I'm mother to both of you. It was cruel of you to keep closing the door between him and me. Nokva's pale face turned even wider. Yes, Mother, I closed the door. Cruel, you say? May Jesus comfort you, but you don't know. His voice faded to a whisper, as if the boy's strength were spent. I didn't think you should. We had to spare you. He turned on his heel, went to the door, and unbarred it. But then he paused and stood there with his back to Kristen. Finally, she softly called out his name. He came back and stood before her with his head bowed. Mother, I know this isn't easy for you. She placed her hands on his shoulders. He hid his eyes from her gaze, but he bent down and kissed her on the wrist. Kristen recalled that his father had once done the same, but she couldn't remember when. She stroked his sleeve, and then he lifted his hand and patted her on the cheek. They sat down again, both of them silent for a time. Mother, said Nokfa after a while, his voice steady and quiet, do you still have the cross that my brother Orm left to you? Yes, said Kristen. He made me promise never to part with it. I think if Orm had known about it, he would have consented to letting me have it. I too will now be without inheritance or lineage. Kristen pulled the little silver cross from her bodice. Nokfa accepted it. It was warm from his mother's breast. Respectfully, he kissed the reliquary in the center of the cross, fastened the thin chain around his neck, and hid the cross inside his clothing. Do you remember your brother Orm? Asked his mother. I'm not sure. I think I do. But perhaps that's just because you always talked so much about him, back when I was little. Nokfa sat before his mother for a while longer. Then he stood up. Good night, Mother. May God bless you, Nokfa. Good night. He left her. Kristen folded up the wedding tunic for Ivar, put away her sewing things, and covered the hearth. May God bless you. May God bless you, my Nokfa. Then she blew out the candle and left the old building. Sometime later, Kristen happened to meet Tordis at a manor on the outskirts of the parish. The people there had fallen ill and hadn't been able to bring in the hay, so the brothers and sisters of the Olav Guild had gone to lend them a hand. That evening, Kristen accompanied the girl part of the way home. She walked along slowly, as an old woman does, and chatted. Little by little, she turned the conversation so that Tordis found herself telling Nokfa's mother all about what there had been between the two of them. Yes, she had met with him in the paddock at home, and the summer before, when she was staying up in their mountain pastures, he had come to see her several times at night. But he had never tried to be too bold with her. She knew what people said about Nokva, but he had never offended her in either word or deed. But he had lain beside her on top of the bed covers a few times, and they had talked. She once asked him if it was his intention to court her. He replied that he couldn't. He had promised himself to the service of the Virgin Mary. He told her the same thing in the spring, when they happened to speak to each other. And then she decided that she would no longer resist the wishes of her grandfather and father. It would have brought great sorrow upon both of you if he had broken his promise, and you had defied your kinsmen, said Kristen. She stood leaning on her rake and looked at the young maiden. The child had a gentle, lovely round face and a thick braid of the most beautiful fair hair. God will surely bestow happiness on you, my tortoise. He seems a most intrepid and fine boy, your betrothed.
Yes, I'm quite fond of Havard, said the girl, and began to sob bitterly.
Kristen consoled her with words befitting the lips of an old and sensible woman. Inside, she moaned with longing. She so dearly wished she could have called this good, fresh child her daughter. After Ivar's wedding, she stayed at Ronheim for a while. Sina Gamal's daughter was not beautiful and looked both weary and old, but she was kind and gentle. She seemed to have a deep love for her young husband, and she welcomed his mother and brothers as if she thought them to be so high above her that she couldn't possibly honor or serve them well enough. For Kristen, it was a new experience to have this woman go out of her way to anticipate her wishes and tend to her comfort. Not even when she was the wealthy mistress of Husaby, commanding dozens of servants, did anyone ever serve Kristen in a way that showed they were thinking of the mistress's ease or well-being. She had never spared herself when she bore the brunt of the work for the benefit of the whole household, and no one else ever thought of sparing her either. Sina's obliging concern for the welfare of her mother-in-law during the days she was at Ronheim did Kristen good. She soon grew so fond of Sina that almost as often as she prayed to God to grant Ivar happiness in his marriage, she also prayed that Sina might never have reason to regret that she had given herself and all her properties to such a young husband. Right after Michaelmas, Nokva and Bjørgulf headed north for Trøndelag. The only thing she had heard since then was that they had arrived safely in Nidaros and had been accepted as novices by the Brotherhood at Tautra. And now Kristen had lived at Jørundgard for almost a year with only two of her sons. But she was surprised it wasn't longer than that. On that day the previous fall, when she had come riding past the church and looked down to see the slopes lying under a blanket of cold, raw fog so that she couldn't make out the buildings of her own estate, she had accompanied her two oldest sons as far as Dovre. Then she had thought this was what someone must feel who is riding toward home and knows that the farm lying there is nothing but ashes and cold, charred timbers. Now, whenever she took the old path home past the site of the smithy, and by now it was almost overgrown, with tufts of yellow bedstraw, bluebells, and sweet peas spilling over the borders of the lush meadow, it seemed almost as if she were looking at a picture of her own life. The weather-beaten, soot-covered old hearth that would never again be lit by a fire. The ground was strewn with bits of coal, but thin, short, gleaming tendrils of grass were springing up all over the abandoned site, and in the cracks of the old hearth blossomed fireweed, which sows its seeds everywhere, with its exquisite, long red tassels. Chapter 2. Sometimes, after Kristen had gone to bed, she would be awakened by people entering the courtyard on horseback. There would be a pounding on the door to the loft, and she would hear Gauta greet his guests loudly and joyously. The servants would have to get up and go out. There was a clattering and stomping overhead. Kristen could hear Ingrid's cross voice. Yes, she was a good child, that young maid, and she didn't let anyone get too forward with her. A roar of laughing young voices would greet her sharp and lively words. Frida shrieked. The poor thing, she never grew any wiser. She was not much younger than Kristen, and yet at times her mistress had to keep an eye on her. Then Kristen would turn over in bed and go back to sleep. Gauta was always up before dawn the next morning, as usual. He never stayed in bed any longer, even if he had been up drinking ale the night before. But his guests wouldn't appear until breakfast time. Then they would stay at the manor all day. Sometimes they had trade to discuss. Sometimes it was merely a friendly visit. Gauta was most hospitable. Kristen saw to it that Gauta's friends were offered the best of everything. She wasn't aware that she went about smiling quietly at the hum of youth and merry activity returning to her father's estate. But she seldom talked with the young men, and she saw little of them. What she did see was that Gauta was well-liked and happy. Gauta Erlandsson was as much liked by commoners as by the wealthy landowners. The case against the men who killed Erland had brought great misfortune upon their kin, and there were doubtless people on many manors and belonging to many lineages who vigilantly avoided meeting any of the Erlandssons, but Gauta himself had not a single foe. Sir Sigurd of Sundbu had taken a keen liking to his young kinsman. This cousin of hers, whom Kristen had never met until fate led him to the deathbed of Erland Nikolausson, had shown her the greatest loyalty of a kinsman. He stayed at Uhrengard almost until Christmas and did everything he could to help the widow and her fatherless young boys. The sons of Erland displayed their gratitude in a noble and courteous manner, but only Gauta drew close to him and had spent a great deal of time at Sundbu since then. When this nephew of Ivar Yesling eventually died, the estate would pass out of the hands of his lineage. He was childless, and the Hoftersons were his closest descendants. Sir Sigurd was already quite an old man, and he had endured a terrible fate when his young wife lost her wits during her first childbirth. For nearly 40 years now, he had been married to this madwoman, but he still went in almost daily to see how she was doing. She lived in one of the best houses at Sundbu, and had many maids to look after her. "Do you know me today, Gerid?" her husband would ask. Sometimes she didn't answer, but other times she said, "I know you well. You're the prophet Isaiah, who lives north at Brattvite, beneath Brattvite Peak." She always had a spindle at her side. When she was feeling good, she would spin a fine, even yarn. But when things were bad, she would unravel her own work and strew all over the room the wool that her maids had carded. After Gauta had told Kristen about this, she always welcomed her cousin with the most heartfelt kindness when he came to visit. But she declined to go to Sundbu. She hadn't been there since the day of her wedding. Gauta Erlandsson was much smaller in stature than Kristen's other sons. Between his tall mother and lanky brothers, he looked almost short. But he was actually of average height. In general, Gauta seemed to have grown larger in all respects now that his two older brothers and the twins, who were born after him, had left. Beside them, he had always been a quiet figure. People in the region called him an exceedingly handsome man, and he did have a lovely face. With his flaxen yellow hair and big gray eyes so finely set beneath his brow, with his narrow, suitably full countenance, fresh complexion, and beautiful mouth, he looked much like his grandfather Lavrans. His head was handsomely set on his shoulders, and his hands, which were well-shaped and rather large, were unusually strong. But the lower half of his body was a little too short, and he was quite bow-legged. For this reason, he always wore his clothing long unless, for the sake of his work, he had to put on a short tunic, although at the time it was more and more thought to be elegant and courtly for men to have their banquet attire cut shorter than in the past. The farmers learned of this fashion from traveling noblemen who passed through the valley. But whenever Gauta Erlandsson arrived at church or at a feast wearing his ankle-length embroidered green Sabbath surcoat, the silver belt around his waist, and the great cape with the squirrel-skin lining thrown back over his shoulders, the people of the parish would turn pleased and gentle eyes on the young master of Uhrengard. Gauta always carried a magnificent silver-chased axe Lavrans Björgulfsson had inherited from his father-in-law, Ivar Gessling. And everyone thought it splendid to see Gauta Erlandsson following in the footsteps of his forefathers, even as young as he was, and keeping up the good farming traditions of the past in his attire, demeanor, and the way he lived. On horseback, Gauta was the handsomest man anyone had ever seen. He was the boldest of riders, and people in the countryside boasted there wasn't a horse in all of Norway that Gauta couldn't manage to tame and ride. When he was in Bjørgvin the year before, he had purportedly mastered a young stallion that no man had ever been able to handle or ride. Under Gauta's hand, he was so submissive that he could be ridden without a saddle and with a maiden's ribbons as reins. But when Kristen asked her son about this story, he merely laughed and refused to talk about it. Kristen knew that Gauta was reckless in his dealings with women, and this did not please her, but she thought it was mostly because the women treated the handsome young man much too kindly, and Gauta had an open and charming manner. Surely it was largely banter and foolishness. He didn't take such matters seriously or go about concealing things the way Nokva had. He came and told his mother himself when he had conceived a child with a young girl over at Sundbu. That had happened 2 years ago. Kristen heard from Sir Sigurd that Gauta had generously provided the mother with a good dowry, befitting her position, and he wanted to bring the child to Jørungard after she had been weaned from her mother's breast. He seemed to be quite fond of his little daughter. He always went to see her whenever he was at Vaga. She was the loveliest child, Gauta proudly reported, and he had had her baptized Monhild. Kristen agreed that since the boy had sinned, it was best if he brought the child home and became her loyal father. She looked forward with joy to having little Monhild live with them. But then she died, only a year old. Gauta was greatly distressed when he heard the news, and Kristen thought it sad that she had never seen her little granddaughter. Kristen had always had a difficult time reprimanding Gauta. He had been so miserable when he was little, and later he had continued to cling to his mother more than the other children had. Then there was the fact that he resembled her father. And he had been so steadfast and trustworthy as a child. With his somber and grown-up manner, he had walked at her side and often lent her a well-intentioned helping hand that he, in his childish innocence, thought would be of the greatest benefit to his mother. No, she had never been able to be stern with Gauta. When he did something wrong out of thoughtlessness or the natural ignorance of his years, he never needed more than a few gentle admonishing words. So sensible and wise the boy was. When Gauta was 2 years old, their house priest at Husaby, who had a particularly good understanding of childhood illnesses, advised that the boy be given mother's milk again, since no other measures had helped. The twins were newborns, and Frida, who was nursing Skula, had much more milk than the infant could consume. But the maid found the poor boy loathsome. Gauta looked terrible, with his big head and thin, wizened body. He could neither speak nor stand on his own. She was afraid he might be a changeling, even though the child had been healthy and fair-looking up until he fell ill at the age of 10 months. All the same, Frida refused to put Gauta to her breast, and so Kristen had to nurse him herself, and he was allowed to suckle until he was 4 winters old. Since then, Frida had never liked Gauta. She was always scolding him, as much as she dared for fear of his mother. Frida now sat next to her mistress on the women's bench and carried her keys whenever Kristen was away from home. She said whatever she liked to the mistress and her family. Kristen showed her great forbearance and found the woman amusing, even though she was often annoyed with her too. Nevertheless, she always tried to make amends and smooth things over whenever Frida had done something wrong or spoken too coarsely. Now the maid had a hard time accepting that Gauta sat in the high seat and was to be master of the estate. She seemed to consider him no more than a foolish boy. She boasted about his brothers, especially Björgulf and Skula, whom she had nursed, while she mocked Gauta's short stature and crooked legs. Gauta took it with good humor. "Well, you know, Frida, if I had nursed at your breast, I would have become a giant just like my brothers. But I had to be content with my mother's breast. And he smiled at Kristen. Mother and son often went out walking in the evening. In many places, the path across the fields was so narrow that Kristen had to walk behind Gauta. He would stroll along, carrying the long hafted axe, so manly that his mother had to smile behind his back. She had an impetuous, youthful desire to rush at him from behind and pull him to her, laughing and chattering with Gauta the way she had done occasionally when he was a child. Sometimes they would go all the way down to the place on the riverbank where the washing was done and sit down to listen to the roar of the water rushing past, bright and roiling in the dusk. Usually they said very little to each other. But once in a while Gauta would ask his mother about the old days in the region and about her own lineage. Kristen would tell him what she had heard and seen in her childhood. His father and the years at Husaby were never mentioned on those nights. "Mother, you're sitting here shivering," Gauta said one evening. "It's cold tonight." "Yes, and I've grown stiff from sitting on the stone," Kristen stood up. "I'm getting to be an old woman, my Gauta." Walking back, she placed her hand on his shoulder for support. Lavrans was sleeping like a rock in his bed. Kristen lit the little oil lamp. She felt like sitting up for a while to enjoy the sea calm in her own soul. And there was always some task to occupy her hands. Upstairs, Gauta was clattering around with something. Then she heard him climb into bed. Kristen straightened her back for a moment, smiling a bit at the tiny flame in the lamp. She moved her lips faintly, making the sign of the cross over her face and breast, and in the air in front of her. Then she picked up her sewing again. Bjorn, the old dog, stood up and shook himself, stretching out his front paws full length as he yawned. He padded across the floor to his mistress. As soon as she started petting him, he placed his front paws on her lap. When she spoke to him gently, the dog eagerly licked her face and hands as he wagged his tail. Then Bjorn slunk off again, turning his head to peer at Kristen. Guilt shone in his tiny eyes and was evident in his whole bulky, wiry-haired body, right down to the tip of his tail. Kristen smiled quietly and pretended not to notice. Then the dog jumped up onto her bed and curled up at the foot. After a while, she blew out the lamp, pinched the spark off the wick, and tossed it into the oil. The light of the summer night was rising outside the little window pane. Kristen said her last prayers of the day, silently undressed, and slipped into bed. She tucked the pillows comfortably under her breast and shoulders, and the old dog settled against her back. A moment later, she fell asleep. Bishop Hallvard had assigned Sira Dog to the cleric's position in the parish, and from him Gauta had purchased the bishop's tithes for 3 years hence. He had also traded for hides and food in the region, sending the goods over the winter roads to Raumsdal, and from there by ship to Bjørgvin in the spring. Kristen wasn't pleased with these ventures of her son. She herself had always sold her goods in Hamar because both her father and Simon Andersen had done so. But Gauta had formed some sort of trade partnership with his kinsman Gerlach Paus, and Gerlach was a clever merchant, with close ties to many of the richest German merchants in Bjørgvin. Erland's daughter Margaret and her husband had come to Jørundgard during the summer after Erland's death. They presented great gifts to the church for his soul. When Margaret was a young maiden back home at Husaby, there had been scant friendship between her and her stepmother, and she had cared little for her small half-brothers. Now she was 30 years old, with no children from her marriage. Now she showed her handsome, grown-up brothers the most loving sisterly affection. And she was the one who arranged the agreement between Gauta and her husband. Margaret was still beautiful, but she had grown so big and fat that Kristen didn't think she had ever seen such a stout woman. But there was all the more room for silver links on her belt, while a silver brooch as large as a small shield fit nicely between her enormous breasts. Her heavy body was always adorned like an altar with the costliest of fabrics and gilded metals. Gerlach T. Deckinson seemed to have the greatest love for his wife. A year earlier, Gaute had visited his sister and brother-in-law in Bjørgvin during the spring meetings, and in the fall he traveled over the mountains with a herd of horses, which he sold in town. The journey turned out to be so profitable that Gaute swore he would do it again this autumn. Kristen thought he should be allowed to do as he wished. No doubt he had some of his father's lust for travel in his blood. Surely he would settle down as he grew older. When his mother saw that he was aching to get away, she urged him to go. Last year he had been forced to come home through the mountains at the height of winter. He set off on a beautiful sunny morning right after St. Bartholomew's Day. It was the time for slaughtering the goats, and the whole manor smelled of cooked goat meat. Everyone had eaten his fill and was feeling content. All summer long they had tasted no fresh meat except on high holy days, but now they had their share of the pungent meat and the strong fatty broth at both breakfast and supper for many days. Kristen was exhausted and elated after helping with the first big slaughtering of the year and making sausages. She stood on the main road and waved with a corner of her wimple at Gaute's entourage. It was a lovely sight. Splendid horses and fresh young men riding along with glittering weapons and jangling harnesses. There was a great thundering as they rode across the high bridge. Gaute turned in his saddle and waved his hat, and Kristen waved back, giving a giddy little cry of joy and pride. Just after winter day, rain and sleet swept in over the countryside, with storms and snow in the mountains. Kristen was a little uneasy, for Gaute had still not returned. But she was never as fearful for him as she had been for the others. She believed in the good fortune of this son. A week later, Kristen was coming out of the cowshed late one evening when she caught sight of several horsemen up by the manor gate. The fog was billowing like white smoke around the lantern she carried. She began walking through the rain to meet the group of dark, fur-clad men. Could it be Gaute? It was unlikely that strangers would be arriving so late. Then she saw that the rider in front was Sigurd of Sundbu. With the slight stiffness of an old man, he dismounted from his horse. "Yes, I bring you news from Gaute, Kristen," he said after they had greeted each other. "He arrived at Sundbu yesterday." It was so dark she couldn't make out his expression. But his voice sounded so strange. And when he walked toward the door of the main house, he told his men to go with Kristen's stable boy to the servants' quarters. She grew frightened when he said nothing more, but when they were alone in the room, she asked quite calmly, "What news do you bring, kinsman? Is he ill, since he hasn't come home with you?"
"No, Gaute is so well that I've never seen him look better." But his men were tired.
He blew at the foam on the ale bowl that Kristen handed to him, then took a swallow and praised the brew.
"Good ale should be given to the one who brings good news," said the mistress with a smile.
"Well, I wonder what you'll say when you've heard all of my news," he remarked rather diffidently. "He did not return alone this time, your son."
Kristen stood there waiting. "He has brought along...
Well, she's the daughter of Helga of Hovland. He has apparently taken this maiden, taken her by force from her father."
Kristen still said nothing, but she sat down on the bench across from him. Her lips were narrow and pressed tight.
"Gaute asked me to come here. I suppose he was afraid you wouldn't be pleased. He asked me to tell you the news, and now I've done so," concluded Sir Sigurd faintly.
"You must tell me everything you know about this matter, Sigurd," said Kristen calmly.
Sir Sigurd did as she asked, in a vague and disjointed way, with a great deal of roundabout talk. He himself seemed to be quite horrified by Gaute's action. But from his account, Kristen discerned that Gaute had met the maiden in Bjørgvin the year before. Her name was Jofrid, and no, she had not been abducted. But Gaute had probably realized that it would do no good to speak to the maiden's kinsmen about marriage. Helga of Hovland was a very wealthy man and belonged to the lineage known as Duke, with estates all over Voss.
And then the devil had tempted the two young people. Sir Sigurd tugged at his clothing and scratched his head, as if he were swarming with lice. Then, this past summer, when Kristin thought that Gauta was at Sundbu and was going to accompany Sir Sigurd into the mountain pastures to hunt for two vicious bears, he had actually journeyed over the heights and down to Sogn. Jofrid was staying there with a married sister. Helga had three daughters and no sons. Sigurd groaned in distress. Yes, he had promised Gauta to keep silent about this. He knew the boy must be going to see a maiden, but he had never dreamed that Gauta was thinking of doing anything so foolish. "Yes, my son is going to have to pay dearly for this," replied Kristin. Her face was impassive and calm. Sigurd said that winter had now set in for good, and the roads were nearly impassable. After the men of Hovland had had time to think things over, perhaps they would see. It was best if Gauta won Jofrid with the consent of her kinsmen, now that she was already his. But what if they don't see things that way, and demand revenge for abducting a woman? Sir Sigurd squirmed and scratched even more. "I suppose it's an unredeemable offense," he said quietly. "I'm not quite certain." Kristin did not reply. Then Sir Sigurd continued, his voice imploring. "Gauta said he expected that you would welcome them kindly. He said that surely you are not so old that you've forgotten. Well, he said that you won the husband you insisted on having. Do you understand?" Kristin nodded. "She's the fairest child I have ever seen in my life, Kristin," said Sigurd fervently. Tears welled up in his eyes. "It's terrible that the devil has lured Gauta into this misdeed, but surely you will receive these two poor children with kindness, won't you?" Kristin nodded again. The countryside was sodden the next day, pallid and black under torrents of rain when Gauta rode into the courtyard around mid-afternoon prayers. Kristin felt a cold sweat on her brow as she leaned against the doorway. There stood Gauta, lifting down from her horse a woman dressed in a hooded black cloak. She was small in build, barely reaching up to his shoulders. Gauta tried to take her hand to lead her forward, but she pushed him away and came to meet Kristin alone. Gauta busied himself talking to the servants and giving orders to the men who had accompanied him. Then he cast another glance at the two women standing in front of the door. Kristin was holding both hands of the newly arrived girl. Gauta rushed over to them with a joyful greeting on his lips. In the entryway, Sir Sigurd put his arm around his shoulder and gave him a fatherly pat, huffing and puffing after the strain. Kristin was taken by surprise when the girl lifted her face, so white and so lovely inside the drenched hood of her cloak, and she was so young and as small as a child. Then the girl said, "I do not expect to be welcomed by you, Gauta's mother, but now all doors have been closed to me except this one. If you will tolerate my presence here on the manor, mistress, then I will never forget that I arrived here without property or honor, but with good intentions to serve you and Gauta, my lord." Before she knew it, Kristin had taken the girl's hands and said, "May God forgive my son for what he has brought upon you, my fair child. Come in, Jofrid. May God help both of you, just as I will help you as best I can." A moment later, she realized that she had offered much too warm a welcome to this woman, whom she did not know. But by then, Jofrid had taken off her outer garments. Her heavy winter gown, which was a pale blue woven homespun, was dripping wet at the hem, and the rain had soaked right through her cloak to her shoulders. There was a gentle, sorrowful dignity about this childlike girl. She kept her small head with its dark tresses gracefully bowed. Two thick, pitch-black braids fell past her waist. Kristin kindly took Jofrid's hand and led her to the warmest place on the bench next to the hearth. "You must be freezing," she said. Gauta came over and gave his mother a hearty embrace. "Mother, things will happen as they must. Have you ever seen as beautiful a maiden as my Jofrid? I had to have her, whatever it may cost me. And you must treat her with kindness. my dearest mother.
Jofrid Helge's daughter was indeed beautiful. Kristen could not stop looking at her. She was rather short, with wide shoulders and